Right, please turn to Luke chapter 15. I'm going to read the first 10 verses. Luke 15, beginning at verse 1. Then all the tax collectors and sinners drew near to him to hear him. And the Pharisees and scribes complained, saying, "This man receives sinners and eats with them." So he spoke this parable to them, saying, "What man of you, having 100 sheep, if he loses one of them, does not leave the 99 in the wilderness and go after the one which is lost until he finds it? And when he has found it, he lays it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he comes home, he calls together his friends and neighbors, saying to them, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep which was lost.' I say to you that likewise there will be more joy in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 just persons who need no repentance. Or what woman, having 10 silver coins, if she loses one coin, does not light a lamp, sweep the house, and search carefully until she finds it? And when she has found it, she calls her friends and neighbors together, saying, 'Rejoice with me, for I have found the piece which I had lost.' Likewise, I say to you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents." What is God like? What is God like? It's an interesting question, and you know, as many people as you meet, there'll probably be as many answers. But for those who are Christians, the question has been wonderfully answered already. God is like Jesus because God himself has come to us in the person of Jesus. He's Emmanuel. He's God with us. What does God think of sinners? What does Jesus think of sinners? How will God react to sinners who turn to him? How did Jesus react to sinners who turn to him? What does God think of religious hypocrisy? What did Jesus think of religious hypocrisy? So Jesus could say, "No man has seen God at any time, but the only Son who is in the bosom of the Father has declared him." Or even in John 14, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me." And so the gospel stories, the records of some of the things, and they are only some of the things that Jesus said and did, are the reminder to us of who God is, what he is like, and what he has done for us in Jesus, and what he still is and always will be to us in Jesus. The last part of Luke's gospel, we looked at the story of the parable of the man who prepares the feast, and it's a picture of God himself, Jesus said, and the various guests are the human responses to God and his graciousness and his goodness. Jesus finished off that section, interestingly, with this challenge: "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." And immediately, and of course there are no chapter divisions in the original, look at what it says immediately after that. All the tax collectors and sinners drew near to him to hear him. So the most unsurprising, or the most surprising people, I should say, show up to answer Jesus' call: "He who has ears to hear, let him hear." And the ones who we think should have ears to hear are the ones who not only don't listen themselves, the religious leaders, but want to stop those who are listening from continuing to listen. Well, what are we to make of all of this? Well, Jesus does something which should not be unexpected if we know the Old Testament background. He tells us a very, very simple story here. But it's more than a simple story about a sheep being lost and found. It is that, of course, and that pictures the sinner being lost and found. Within that story, and in the way he illustrates that story of the shepherd and the sheep, he is, I suppose today we would say, he's pushing certain buttons. He's reminding his hearers, who are all Jews at this point, that this is not unexpected. That God has said that this is the way it would be. So as the tax collectors and sinners come to Jesus, instead of it causing rejoicing amongst the religious leaders, it causes controversy and scandal. Whereas Jesus points out that the real scandal is that the religious leaders mirror, point for point, the lazy, selfish shepherds that were introduced to in Ezekiel chapter 34. But of course, the point of Ezekiel 34 isn't just that the shepherds, the religious leaders, are neglecting their role, is that God isn't dependent on them, because God prophesies through Ezekiel that he himself will come to rescue his sheep. And so this idea of the shepherd and the sheep, it's a key idea in all of the scriptures. Perhaps the one we're most familiar with, of course, is Psalm 23. Yahweh, the Lord, is my shepherd. So before the false shepherds are confronted in Ezekiel, the template has been set by David in the Psalm, the Lord is my shepherd. In Psalm 80, the Psalm says, give ear. He addresses God. Just look at how he addresses him. O shepherd of Israel, you who lead Joseph like a flock, restore us, O God, that we may be saved. In the great prophecy of Isaiah 40, of the suffering servant who's going to come to do God's will, he's described as a shepherd. He will tend his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms and will carry them in his bosom. By the way, these notes are in your notes this morning. And in the piece we looked at, both Jeremiah and here in Ezekiel, the religious leaders are challenged and rebuked for not exercising the role of under-shepherds that was commissioned to them. So according to the prophets, God's people they're like lost sheep. But the story has the happiest of happy endings. The good shepherd himself will come to seek and to save that which is lost. I myself will search for my sheep. I will seek them out. Ezekiel 34, we read it earlier on. And in Jeremiah 23, in verses 3 and 5, you can read it later on yourself. Similar promises made. And this time it's very clear that this saving shepherd is going to be the Son of David. It's going to be the Messiah himself. So in this very, very simple story, by the imagery that Jesus chooses to use here, he is, yes, of course, illustrating to us, primarily in this context, the attitude of God towards sinners. But he's also making a claim about himself, that he's the good shepherd. He expands on that, as we all know, in John 10, and you can read that as well. So what is God like? Well, we see here, with regard to lost sinners, exactly what God is like. So let's look very, very briefly then at some of the things that, I suppose, jump out at us here. First of all, there's obviously the lostness of the sheep. And again, this is a favorite theme, not only in the Old Testament with regard to God's people, but Jesus himself. You remember in Matthew's gospel, it says he looked upon the multitudes and he had compassion on them, for they were like sheep who had no shepherd. Now, interestingly, we're not told he said that out loud, but we're told that that's what's happening in his heart. But then he says, come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. That's the heart of the good shepherd, isn't it? So the sheep is lost. And here, Jesus is probably alluding to Isaiah 53, because the sheep is lost because they've wandered. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way. But the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. And although it's not expanded on here, if people cared to go back and look at the references in the Old Testament, they would have begun to get the picture that not only does God come and save his lost sheep, but the extent to which he's prepared to go. And we'll deal with that in a little bit more detail in a few moments. Secondly, as Jesus, and remember, he's telling this parable, he's telling this story, and it's working on so many different levels, but he's primarily telling it as a rebuke to the religious leaders in the context of them not understanding what's happening. As he gives out the call, he who has ears to hear, let him hear. And then the sinners come and draw near to him to hear him. And he's focusing here on the fact that just one sheep was lost. And he starts off by saying, well, what would you do if one of your sheep was lost? Would you say, well, we'll just write it off and it's better to have 99 than 98? No, he says, you would do everything. Why? Because even one sheep would be precious to you. Now, the point he's making here, and it's very similar, by the way, to the illustration he uses in the synagogue, if you remember, when the religious leaders confronted him for healing the woman who had been bent over for so many years. And he says to them, what would you do if one of your animals fell into the ditch? Would you just leave it there and say, well, that's just too bad? No, you'd pull it out, even if it was the Sabbath day. How much more should this daughter of Abraham not be healed, and so on? And the point here is that individuals are important to God. So we're looking here, aren't we, at God's people as the flock, but the flock is composed of individuals. And the individuals are important, not just because God looks on people and says, yes, every individual is important to me. We see later on in our next hymn, not one that believes on him shall ever be finally lost. It's wonderful news for us, but primarily it's saying something about him. It's saying that our God in Jesus is so good and so wise and so gracious and so compassionate that not one of his people will be lost, because if they were lost, it would diminish his glory. And if you forget everything else I say, and please try not to, remember this, that your salvation is guaranteed not because of who you are, but because of who Jesus is. That Jesus will not dim his glory by allowing you to be lost. That the guarantee of your salvation is who Jesus is. And so he only sees his work as complete when all his people are gathered in. How many more are to be gathered in? I have not got a clue. Because he hasn't told me, and I don't need to know. Neither do you. But we know this, that when the last of them is gathered in, time will cease, eternity will begin, and it's going to be wonderful. He develops this theme in much more detail, doesn't he, in John chapter 10, about the sheep and how none of those will be lost and no one can snatch even one of them out of his hand. The third thing here is that the sheep are lost, and by being lost, they are in mortal danger. The wolves can come and snatch them away. They can die of dehydration. They can die of hunger. There any amount of things, none of which are good, is liable to happen to them in their lost condition. But of course, for the shepherd to rescue them, he has to go exactly where they are. If they're in danger from the wild animals, he has to put himself where the wild animals are. He has to put himself between them and the wild animals. If they're dehydrated, he has to search for water for them. He has to search for food for them. He has to be, to the nth degree, the good shepherd of Psalm 23. And so there's a hint for us here, but only a hint, of that great truth, that when the shepherd searches for the sheep, it's not just a testimony to his faithfulness, to his meticulousness, to his graciousness, but it's a testimony that he's prepared to come all the way to where they are. It's Philippians 2, isn't it, in action? He humbled himself, took upon himself the form of a servant, and he died even the death on the cross. Whatever needs to be done, the shepherd is prepared to do. And fourthly, in the story here, the shepherd is sought until found. He doesn't just put in a really good effort, then eventually look at his watch or look at his diary and say, well, boy, there's really not much point in investing more time. I've done as much as I can do. We'll just have to write that one off. All these points, of course, are tied together, aren't they? That there's a persistence here of God's gracious love in Jesus. He goes to where the sheep are. He does what is needed to be done to save them. And he persists in all that needs to be done until that is applied to their life. And again, what an encouragement to us here. Maybe some of us have been praying for, quote unquote, lost sheep in our family circle, or lost sheep that we know at work or at school. And we say, well, are they ever going to get saved? We have to persist, don't we? We are the intersection, if you like, between the good shepherd seeking and finding. Because he's using our words, he's using our attitudes, he's using our persistence. And the sheep are sought until they are found. The great German reformer, who was one of Luther's disciples, Philip Melanchthon, taught on this parable. And he said that interwoven into the text is this great truth. It is a sweet signification of the passion of Christ. He places upon his shoulders the sheep he has found. That is, he transfers to himself . And I think what Melanchthon is getting on there is that when the sheep is so lost, and I suppose the illustration of the sheep only captures some of the lostness that we are in, that when the shepherd comes, he takes full responsibility for the sheep. He doesn't say, well, you know, try and get up there and give it your best shot. And, you know, if you walk a few steps, then I'll help you walk a few more steps. He puts it on his shoulders and carries it all the way home. And isn't that what Jesus is trying to say here? He's not just saying, that's what I will do and that's what I do. He's saying that in that's what God is like. You can trust him, even though you don't deserve it, to carry you all the way home. And the sheep then, finally in this section, once found, brings great joy. Luke's gospel, all the gospels are ultimately gospels. They're good news. And here in both of these illustrations, he talks about the joy there is, the celebration, the amazing joy that there is in heaven over one sinner who repents. It's as though Jesus, and we're only glimpsing here the work he invests in the salvation of sinners. As he looks on us and we look on him in heaven, and even before we get to heaven, in heaven itself, in the throne room of God, there is great joy. Why? Because this is what God is all about. This is why he has sent Jesus, because this is who he is. It is his joy that he be glorified and that his love, the love that he is, overflow into the salvation of sinners. There's nothing grudging about the salvation of God. And so in Hebrews 12, when we're called to follow in the footsteps of the great champions of faith that we meet in chapter 11, ultimately we're told to look to Jesus. Look at how Jesus is described here. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. That's the idea of him carrying us all the way home, isn't it? Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. We're told that in the book of Revelation, as John glimpses into the glory that is heaven and the glory that we anticipate in the new heavens and the new earth, that Jesus is still pictured as the Lamb that was slain. As it were, bearing still in his glorified reality the marks of Calvary. No longer as marks of pain, but as marks of triumph and now of joy. That Jesus, fulfilling his Father's will in saving us, is incredibly joyful. He shall see the travail of his soul, it says in Isaiah 53, and be satisfied. So the impression we get is not, oh, that was horrible, I'm glad that's all over. But it was all worth it, because I have fulfilled what God has sent me to do. Briefly then, looking at the second parable here, it's much shorter. And it wonders, in ways, as I was reading this, so why did Luke even include this? Why did Jesus tell this? It comes, it's the same illustration, much, much shorter, comes to the same conclusion, joy in the presence of the angel of God over one sinner who repents. But if you look, there is a big, big difference. The key character here is actually a woman. And the illustration is an illustration that a woman in particular would have related to. And one of the things you notice in Luke's gospel is he gives women a key role in his account of the life and ministry of Jesus. And it's as though in Luke's gospel in particular, it's anticipating that spiritual equality that we see there under the new covenant. As I say, there's no extra truth taught to us in this parable, but the one who's used to illustrate it is a woman. It's probable that these 10 coins are her dowry that she's brought into the marriage. And they're as precious to her as the sheep are to the shepherd. So the illustration is one that a woman in particular could relate to. And if you go very, very quickly through Luke's description, very often he'll have an incident where a man is used or a man is ministered to, and immediately afterwards he'll have a woman. It's as though he's trying to make a point. So, for example, Luke's gospel starts off with this person, Zacharias, is in the temple, and an angel comes to him with a wonderful message. But then immediately afterwards we meet a woman who gets an even more wonderful message. It's Mary, isn't it? Jesus is brought to the temple and he meets a man, Simeon, who praises God for what God has done. And straight away he meets a woman who praises God. They're not saying anything different, but Luke is saying, look, this is not just for Jews, it's also for Gentiles. It's not just for those who are free, it's also for slaves. And believe it or not, it's not just for men, it's for women also. This is for everybody. This is the best of good news. In his sermon in Nazareth, Jesus spoke about widows as well as lepers. In chapter 4, he heals a man who's possessed. Immediately afterwards, he heals Simon's mother-in-law. He forgives the paralytic his sins in chapter 5. And then in chapter 7, the woman who's a sinner demonstrates her forgiveness as she weeps over his feet. And you can go through there and search it yourself. I'm not going to do all the work for you. But if you go through, you see quite a number of these. And the point is that they're not telling us an extra spiritual truth, it seems to me. But they're saying what needed to be said in this context. By the way, this good news is for everybody. Everybody needs it. And all who come to Jesus will receive it. And it's anticipating, isn't it, that great truth that Paul will expand upon in his ministry that this good news about Jesus transforms the lives of everyone, Gentile and Jew, slaves and free, barbarians, Scythians, male and female, all are one in Christ Jesus. This man receives sinners, they said, in condemnation. And we say, amen. This man receives sinners, and God is glorified in it, because this man is not just a man. Behold our God. This is Emmanuel. This is who God is. This is what is God is like.